You know, in contrast to your delightful mood, and you are delightful, I want to take advantage of your good nature for a moment and tell you of a couple who've been married for 30 years, and unfortunately for 30 years, it's been murder. But murder. Finally, there they are at the bar of justice. The judge listens very carefully and says there's only one solution to your situation, a divorce. She says, I'll give him a divorce. If he'll drop dead, I'll give him a divorce. Suffered already without creep for 30 years. Now I should make him happy. She says, I wouldn't be satisfied till he leaves me the way he found me. And the judge says, that's ridiculous. Only a miracle can create that. She says, get the hell out of here. What kind of miracle? He found me a widow. Let him leave me a widow. They continue this arguing, this bickering, and the judge insisted upon quiet. Now, I says, as I told you, I listened to both sides very carefully. And in this instance, my dear lady, I must find for you, with the result that I'm going to give you $50 a week and $75 a month toward your rent. And the husband says, you know, judge, you're a damn nice fellow. He says, I'll also throw in a couple dollars. With winter coming upon us, if you don't mind, I should like to revive a story I did some time back about a terrible winter night, one I hope you never have to experience. 20 degrees below zero, 10 feet of snow on the ground, nothing moving, nothing, no night fit for man or beast. Yet despite that, here is a little guy with boots up to his hips, galoshes over the boots, rubbers over the galoshes, three overcoats, four sweaters beneath, three pairs of mittens, earlaps for his earmuffs. He walks into a bakery shop and he says to the baker, give me two rolls. Seedless yet. Now that annoyed the baker because they had to rummage through 200 or 300 rolls to find two seedless rolls. He finally did. Into the bag they went. He says, anything else? He says, no, just like this, two rolls. Baker says, could I maybe interest you in one jelly dole nuts? He says, just two rolls. Baker says, a cookie maybe? Two rolls. Baker says, you mean you left your home on a miserable night like tonight for two crummy rolls? He says, that's what I did it. Baker says, tell me, you married? He says, well, Dan, my mother would send me out on a night like tonight. Just before I came on, one of our very fine captains gave me a note for some folks in the audience, and gosh, any request you make is a command to me. I mean that. I have so much to be grateful for in your friendship, and that's not actor talk. I want to do the story. I haven't done it in many years, and I hope I can remember it. It's about a couple married some years, and unfortunately, they found it a bit difficult to make both ends meet. And then suddenly he found himself a fine position. He made a good living. They mixed with nicer people. And then, of course, the finer, the more cultural things in life became most important. Just a few weeks ago, they invited out this very lovely home. And the evening was devoted to fine music and fine composers. They heard names such as Beethoven, Mendelssohn, Verdi, Puccini. Suddenly someone happened to mention Mozart. She says, Mozart. Just happens I know him very good. In fact, I saw him get on a number 5 bus this morning to go to the beach. And there was a hush in the place. It seemed horror-stricken of what was certainly a ridiculous remark. However, the party being in good taste, nothing more was said about it. The evening was finally over, and they were on the way home. In the confines of their own car, the husband turned to the wife, as husbands will, on occasion. Somebody ask you to open up your mouth. Couldn't sit quiet like a duchess. Got to open up that big fresa. Everybody should know you're stupid. You know goddamn well the number 5 boss don't go to the beach. He Here's a gentleman sitting in a plane. To his left, a lovely lady, a stranger, wearing a fantastically large diamond, the largest diamond he'd ever laid his eyes on or ever hoped to see. He was hypnotized by it, couldn't take his eyes off it. And finally tore himself away from it long enough to turn to her and say, "Pardon me, lady. I don't want you to think that I'm a fresh guy. I'm not starting up with you. But a diamond like this, I didn't see it ever since God knows. Must be white." She says, "Yes, it happens to be the Kloppman diamond." He says, "The what?" She says, "The Kloppman diamond." He said, "What the hell is this?" "Well," she says, "it's like the Hope diamond. It comes with a curse." Says, "What's the curse with this?" She says, "Mr. Kloppman." Let me tell you about a husband who came home, and as he opened the door to his apartment, he seemed to sense the strong odor of cigar smoke. Said to his wife, "Since when are you smoking cigars?" She says, "Get the hell out of here." He said, "Don't change the subject. Since when you're smoking cigars?" She says, "I don't smoke no cigars. I smoke Parliament Kinks." Me the flip-top box. In a quarter inch away. He says, "Then if you're not smoking, you must have a man in the apartment." She says, "A man? I don't need you. What the hell I need with him?" Well, he was a trusting soul, so he began searching the apartment. Kitchen, living room, bedroom, closets. Finally walked into the bathroom. They had a circular shower. He pulled the curtain aside. There was a man standing there. I said, "What the hell are you doing here?" The guy says, "I'm voting." I got a switch on that for you. About a husband who comes home under a similar circumstance, begins searching the apartment, finally opens a closet door. There's a guy standing there in shorts. He said, "What the hell are you doing here?" The guy says, "Everybody gotta be someplace." At some time or other in your lives, you've been a part of just this kind of a conversation. See if it isn't strangely familiar. Two men who have evidently known each other for years will meet on rare occasions. In meeting, as they approach each other, one will do this. "I happen to know the Barnum and Bailey Circus people, and I'm going to get you an elephant for $100. Says, "You're going to what?" He says, "I'm going to get you an elephant for $100. He says, "Who the hell ordered it?" "Not just like this, an elephant. He's trained. Could be a butler." "Sits down, he presses your pants. He could hang up your coat high. Could give you a shower." "He says, who the hell needs a shower? And what the hell am I going to do with an elephant?" "Eats peanuts." "So what the hell I could eat? Let him eat chicken chow mein. What the hell I could..." "What am I going to do with an elephant?" "So what the hell are you hollering?" "He's got a trunk." "So I got a hope chest. What the hell you want?" "What am I going to do with an elephant? I live in one room. I ain't even got room for a chihuahua pup. What am I going to do with an elephant?" "All right, come here. I'm going to get you three elephants for $200. He says, "Now you're talking." I must tell you a story the kids love. I hope you'll think it's funny. Repeat it tomorrow morning at the breakfast table to your little ones. It's the jungle. An elephant, thirsty, sticks his trunk down into the water. Along comes a crocodile. Flip! Off goes the end of the trunk, and the elephant goes, "Merry funny, merry funny." I'm sure you're aware that nudism is quite the thing in this country of ours. It seems to be a way of life, living in the sun, healthful, good for the soul, they tell me. I'm halfway there. It is true that some of our states don't agree, but that doesn't necessarily make it wrong. And as a matter of fact, there's a theater in the heart of Times Square at this very moment, showing a nudist film in its original form, taken at a nudist park. And now, with that in mind, imagine one of these nudist parks with all of these lovely ladies and handsome gentlemen walking about happily, enjoying, as they say. Except for one guy with a long beard. A young fellow. A curious man walked up to him and said, "What the hell is with you? Everybody's walking around like this, you got to be like that." "What the hell is with the beard?" He said, "Somebody has to go out for coffee." And you know, strangely enough, each time I tell that, I get a mental picture of this guy. And what do you suppose disturbs me most about him? Where in the world does he keep the change? Now, you're not going to believe this, but you hear the very same things I do. You may not pay very much attention to them, but I like to use them in my work since truth is so much stranger than fiction. And again, on my word, I didn't dream this up. I didn't write it. Nobody wrote it for me. It actually did happen in Vegas not too many months back in the lounge at the Flamingo. And this, I swear to you, is true. There were two little women sitting at the bar in the cocktail lounge. And I heard a woman say to another, "Are you having another?" She says, "No, it's only the way my coat is buttoned." To say nothing, the man who says to a friend, "Where did you was last winter?" Says, "We was in Palm Springs." Says, "You was where?" He says, "Palm Springs." So what the hell is, we don't talk good English? "It's not Palm Springs, it's Palm Springs." Says, "You know, you're right, I had it confused with Palm Beach." And how about the lady who says to another, "Where did you was last season?" She says, "We went to Mallorca." She says, "Where's that?" She says, "I don't know, we flew." You're beautiful. If ever in my adult life I've told an audience the truth, what I'm going to tell you now is absolutely the truth, every single solitary word of it, and I'm never going to quit talking about it. You'll understand why in a minute. Sometime back, Robert Goulet and I held forth at the Flamingo in Vegas for many, many weeks. Actually, it was his very first supper club engagement. He was magnificent then. He still is, as you know. Now, every night, among others, I would do these next two quick little stories. Well, of course, I hope you enjoy them, but I think you'll find the afterpiece most amusing because, as I told you, every word of this is true. Every night, I would tell about the fellow in the restaurant who sent for the waiter. He says, "What's that fly doing in my soup?" The waiter looked down. He says, "A backstroke." And I would follow that, but the fellow in the restaurant will send for the waiter. "What's that fly doing in my ice cream?" Waiter says, "Could I help it if he likes winter sports?" Now, we closed at the Flamingo. Goulet went on down to Miami Beach to open at the Deauville. On his opening night in Miami Beach, he'd sung six or seven songs, and the audience belonged to him, as it usually does. In order now to give his voice a bit of a rest, he decided he wanted to tell a little joke, which he very often likes to do. And one of my stories popped into his mind. He says, "My good friend Myron Cohn tells this story, and I'm sure he won't mind if I tell it to you. About the fellow in the restaurant who sent for the waiter." He says, "What's that ice cream doing on my fly?" I swear by everything that's holy, I'll never let him forget it. Now you know what makes him such a fancy singer. Within recent years, particularly on television, with both Johnny Carson and Ed Sullivan, you've heard me talk about a fantastic little man who is just diagonally across the street from the Royal Box here at the Americana. I refer, of course, to little Max Asnes, who owns the Stage Delicatessen just up the street, and I love him, as we all do. Those of you who know him know he's a beautiful human being. We in show business love to go there. He's a great host and has a great sense of humor. He was here last night. Before I tell you some of his gems, I want you to hear these two actual incidents. We were having luncheon at the Stage Delicatessen some months back, and at the next table sat three men, each of whom had evidently ordered a glass of milk. But one fellow said to the waiter, "Make sure my glass is clean." 3 minutes later, the waiter came back and says, "Which one ordered a clean glass?" I told you he was here last night, and he told me a story. He says, "I got for you a jerk. J-O-K-E, jerk. When he says that, I'm ready. I speak both his languages. And this was the joke, believe it or not. He says, a drunken bum is driving his car the wrong way in a one-way street. A cop stops him. Where the hell do you think you're going? Didn't see the arrows?" Says, "I didn't even see the Indians." Some time back, I walked into the Stage Delicatessen. It was about 2:30 in the morning, and before going on home, I stopped at the stage for a late snack. Little Mac saw me coming in and assumed this pose. Now, I'm not exaggerating. I knew he wasn't the Statue of Liberty. So I said, "What?" He said, "Psh." Now I knew it was worse than I thought. So again, I said, "What?" He says, "Highly tonight, highly." Which, of course, means not late. "Highly tonight was here, Georgie Boys." I said, "What?" He says, "Georgie Boys." Now, I had a pretty fair education. I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. I said, "What's Georgie Boys?" He says, "You don't know what's Georgie Boys?" "I don't know what you're talking about." He says, "You're also an American." I said, "I still don't know what you're talking about. What's Georgie Boys?" He says, "From the South, four boys from Georgia." You know, he's right. This is Georgie Boys. Now, so that you don't leave here mystified, I'm going to clear it up for you. Earlier that evening, these four young men were at the Stage Delicatessen having dinner. They were from Atlanta, Georgia. And they sent for Max. When he got to the table, one of these young Atlantans said, "Mr. Max, your food is fine." You notice how I adjust to an area? "Your food is fine. But I'm going to tell you, brother, your matzo balls ain't nothing." "You don't know nothing about no matzo balls." Says, "My grandma, my bubba made matzo balls. When my bubba, my grandma made the matzo balls, she was the talk of the South. He said, you matzo balls are too soft, too fluffy. My bubba's matzo balls was nice and hard. You had to cut them with a knife." Little Max says, "That's the reason your bubba never worked here." Some time back, you may remember, you heard me tell of two little women, each one smoking a cigarette, who hail a taxi cab. While riding along, suddenly one says, "You know, it's a funny thing, you ain't got any hash trays. What I'm supposed to do with the hashes?" Taxi driver says, "Flick it on the floor, I got a woman comes in 3 times a week. You wouldn't necessarily have to understand anything about the men's clothing industry to appreciate this next little bit of nonsense. Here are two partners who manufacture men's clothing, men's suits. One of the partners is going to Rome, where he's privileged to have an audience with His Holiness Pope Paul. And when he returns to the city of New York, his partner asks, "What kind of a fellow's the Pope?" He says, "39 short. There isn't a soul within the hearing of my voice that doesn't know what's going on in the world today. Because that's true. Can't you just imagine these two adorable little women in their 80s discussing world affairs and world politics in their 80s, mind you? And one little 80-year-old says to her girlfriend who is 84, "What do you think about red china?" The other one says, "I'll tell you the truth, on a yellow tablecloth would look beautiful." And for a story I've been associated with for what seems like 100 years, the two partners sitting in the office one morning, and one says to the other, "Jake, what's going to be with a Taft-Hartley bill?" He says, "Pay it, I'll order." You ladies, I know, will agree that when a man provides you with a lovely mink coat, a mink stole, chinchilla, something fine, none of your girlfriends would dare fuss with it, muss it, disturb it. You can fluff it or puff it, but that's as far as you go. Now, why that shouldn't be true with the gentleman audience, I'll never know. How many times, men, have you bought yourselves a magnificent jacket made of a fine fabric, cashmere, vicuna, when along comes a friend, presumably a friend, and the first thing you know, he's got you all out of shape. You'd like to hit him a whack and a kiss up, but you figure, wait till he gets a jacket, you'll get even with him. Now, with that in mind, here's a guy coming down the street wearing a most magnificent jacket, fit him as if it were poured into it, made of a fabric that is so lush, so precious, it as yet has no name. Well, along comes that guy. Oh, boy. Oof. Where the hell did you got a jacket? The goods feels like pussyfall. You know, from the Pussycats. From the Pussycats. Who the hell is the tailor? I say, get the hell out of you. Not going to tell you from the tailor. It's the only jacket like this in the whole world, and that's the way it's going to be it. Well, to make a long story short, he finally prevails upon him to give him the name of the tailor. He goes down to the Lower East Side of New York, walks up four rickety flights of steps into the back, knocks on the door, out comes the little tailor. Says, "You the tailor that made that beautiful jacket for my friend Alice Hyman?" He says, "Yes." He says, "Then you got to make me the same jacket." And the tailor says, "I got to why? I don't got to do a goddamn thing, brother. Only I got to die, that's all. I made this jacket. This is my masterpiece. This is my Rembrandt, my Picasso, you know, the painter. And besides, it's too much trouble and it costs too much money." He says, "How much could a jacket like this be worth?" He says, $1,250. $1,250 for one lousy jacket? What the hell you got it lined with, sturgeon? Why should it cost so much money? He says, "I'll explain you. Before I start out to think about to make this jacket, I call in that high-class photographer from Fifth Avenue, New York. His name is Bacharach. He's a big shot. He comes with an entourage. That's a bunch of people. That's what they told me, means entourage. They study you from many angles. Then they start up to take pictures. They take a whole bunch of pictures. Then they sit down by your table and they have a competence. You know, disgusting. They select the finest picture from you, must be not a question, 100% you. This picture we send to a designer, what we got in Paris. He's a fairy. But a nice boy. He studies the picture and makes a design to fit your complexion with your ensemble. This design we sent to a pattern maker, what we got in Italy. He's all right. Now, we got to have the wolf and two certain kind animals that I don't even know who the hell is this. But I know you could only find them in the mountains in Australia, down under. I ain't got time to go there. I got a bar mitzvah Saturday. a confirmation. But lucky... But lucky for me, I got a nephew in Australia. He's a big game hunter. He owns wild animals. He knows where they're hanging out. So he goes with a safari. He's saying, I got nothing to do with a guy in Paris. Now, you cannot capture these animals because they're hopping from crag to crag. So you got to cut off the wool on the fly. They're very touchy. So we get a touchy safari boy. We give him a pair of shears. When the animal is hopping, the little boy is hopping and it cuts. To make sure that the little boy will keep on hopping, we send another little boy with a long stick. When he cuts off enough wool to make the jacket, this wool we send to the mills in England where they weave the goods. In the meantime, we notify Japan. They should start up 2 butterflies to make a cocoon from where we get a silk for the lining. Guy says, yes, but I got to have the jacket for tomorrow. He says, don't worry, you'll have it. And Khrushchev is not gone too long for us not to remember that this was that big blustering man that loved nothing better than to have 20,000 Russians in Red Square and he'd scream at them for hours. And finally he would finish by saying, everybody in the Russian title refrigerator or washing machine, you don't got it, let me know. And a guy raised his hand, he says, what's your name? I said, Levine. He says, what do you want? He says, I ain't got it. Khrushchev says, I'll take care of that. Now a week goes by, again there are 20,000 Russians in Red Square, and again Khrushchev, everybody in the Russian title, refrigerator or washing machine. You don't got it, let me know. Fellow raised his hand, he says, what's your name? He says, Goldstein. He says, what do you want? He says, what happened to Levine? And I want you to imagine the office of the top man in one of our undercover agencies, talking to one of our undercover agents. This is a soundproof room. Not a word may be heard outside that room. And the top man says to the agent, this is life or death, top secret, highly classified. Only you and I in the world know of this mission. Before I tell you another thing, you must take this poison pellet because you dare not be taken alive. One wrong move and you must take the poison pellet. You dare not be taken alive. You're to go to Yugoslavia. Search out our spy, Goldberg. When you find him, the code message is the sun is shining. He will then give you further instructions. But remember, one false move, you're a dead man. Top secret, highly classified. So he goes all the way to Yugoslavia, searches out the address, 5315 Flickelflaggerstrasse. It was a walk-up. Little bit of a hallway, a bunch of bells and a bunch of names, and lo and behold, there are 2 Goldbergs. Begins fiddling with the poison pellet. Dodges could be the move. So he does as you and I might have done, eeny, meeny, miny, moe, and he pushes the top Goldberg button. The door clicks, he walks to the top, there's a door ajar and a man standing in the doorway. He says, Goldberg? He says, yes. He says, the sun is shining. He says, oh, you want Goldberg to spies on the second floor. You know, I shall always be grateful to our good friend Ed Sullivan for all of the far-off places we got to, particularly during the stress periods in the history of our great nation. Wouldn't surprise me if a good many of you gentlemen in this audience were in those installations when we got there. We loved doing it. It was no big deal. It was a pleasure. We had a lot of fun. We flew in all kinds of planes. The only thing that ever bugged me about those trips was that just before we took off, we had to sign a paper that if we were killed, it was our own fault. But ever since the war in the Pacific, the fellows used to laugh about this. I've been telling it ever since, and I hope somehow it escaped you, because I hope you'll think it funny. About an American flyer shot down by the Japanese. He's captured, now he's being brainwashed. And the Japanese officer says to the American, I'm going to ask you a question. That's awful. I don't laugh at my own jokes. I'm going to ask you a question. And I expect an answer. What are in your base? How many men in your squadron? Or how many praying? The American officer answered, my name is Lieutenant Irving Levine. My serial number is 236. He say, now, no, be wise, guy. I ask you a question. I expect an answer. What are in your base? How many men in your squadron? Or how many praying? My name is Lieutenant Irving Levine. My serial number is 236. He say, now, goddamn you, you're lucky we're both Jewish. It's possible. I never saw one in my temple, but it's possible. I have switched this story. It was originally a Yiddish type story, and I hope you'll think this is funny. This is about a man who calls an undertaker and he says, you better come to my house and make arrangements for the funeral. My wife passed away. Undertaker says, you must be drunk. I buried your wife 2 years ago. He says, yes, but I got married again. The undertaker says, oh, congratulations. What else do you say? Speaking of undertakers, here's an undertaker that called a son-in-law. He says, about your mother-in-law, do you want us to embalm her, cremate her, or bury her? He says, do all three. Don't take chances. And here's a little woman way up in years, way up, who's had a full life and has never wanted for a thing in all of her life. However, now the good Lord sees fit to take her. Here she is on her bed seconds before it's the finish. Momentarily, the end will come. The husband is at the bedside. And with what little strength she can summon up in her last few seconds on this earth, pleadingly she says to her husband, tomorrow for the funeral. This is sad. Tomorrow for the funeral, do me a favor. Let my mother ride with you in the first funeral car. He says, get the hell out of here. She says, please, it's my last request. He says, let her drop dead and go with you in your car. There's a punchline to that. She continues to plead with him, and Bonnie says, all right, I'll let her go, but remember, you're going to spoil my whole damn day. A few weeks ago on my good friend Mr. Ed Sullivan's show out of Hollywood in color, I did a story of a shrimpy little guy, a little runt of a fella, a skinny little thing, couldn't weigh more than 90 pounds soaking wet. Walked into a lumber camp, sought out the head lumberjack looking for a job. The lumberjack says, get out of here. I eat more for breakfast than you weigh. Please, he says, go away. The axe weighs more than you do. But he continued to plead with him. Finally, the lumberjack says, okay, I'm going to give you a chance at it. Here's an axe. Cut down that 6-inch stripling. He stepped up to it, flat. Well, he says, that's not bad. Now, there's a 100-year-old oak. Cut it down. Believe it or not, a half a minute, flat. Lumberjack says, that's fantastic. Where did you learn it? He says, in the Sahara forest. Sahara far? You mean the Sahara Desert? He says, sure, now. This one particular story I want you to hear now was given to me by my good friend Joey Bishop. You know Joey's work. Joey, as a rule, doesn't tell stories, but he knows the kind of thing I like. I must take you back some 2 years for this, because we were doing a dress rehearsal for the Ed Sullivan Show out of Studio 50, right here at 53rd Street and Broadway. I'd already done my stint on the dress rehearsal. Joey told me the story, and I liked it well enough to go on the air that night and do it, little realizing that I was taking my career in my hands, because let's face it, you're only as good as your last show. Thank goodness the nation liked it, and I hope you will. It's about a man who for 20 years of his life was madly in love with a delicacy called matzo ball soup. He wouldn't go to bed a night of his life until he'd had his matzo ball soup. He walked into his favorite restaurant. The waiter had seen him coming, was prepared for him. The customer no sooner sat down than with a flourish, the waiter placed the matzo ball soup before him, went off into a corner to watch this man relish the delight of his life. Well, here he sat, made no attempt to eat, just sat there looking at the plate like a mummy. After about 5 minutes, the waiter could contain himself no longer. So he walked up to the customer and he says, "What's the matter? You don't feel good? Something bothers you?" No answer. Waiter says, "Maybe it's too hot, I'll blow on it." No reply. Again, the waiter says, "Maybe it's too cold, I'll hotten it." Still not a word. Now in despair, the waiter says, "For God's sake, you got to say to somebody something. What the hell is it?" Customer says, "All right, smart guy, taste it." The waiter leaned over, he says, "Where the hell is the spoon?" He says, "Aha." Now, I assume that many of the gentlemen in our audience are sales representatives. And because that's possibly true, I want you to hear a story of a good salesman who called on an organization consisting of three partners, Cohn, Goldberg, and Lipschitz. Very successful, make better stuff. Not exactly better stuff, the better type cheap junk. He steps up to the little information window. There's an adorable little girl sitting behind it. He says, "Good morning, my dear. I'd like to talk to Mr. Cohn, please." She says, "He's out of town." Well, he says, "May I talk with Mr. Goldberg?" "Oh, he's away." "Well, how about Mr. Lipschitz?" "I'm sorry, sir, but he's tied up." He says, "All right, honey, I'll come back in the morning." The next morning, there he is, bright and early. "Good morning, my dear. Mr. Cohn, please." She said, "I'm sorry, he's still away." "Well, how about Mr. Goldberg?" "Oh, he's still out of town." "Well, may I please talk with Mr. Lipschitz?" "I'm sorry, sir, but he's tied up." Well, this went on 5 days in a row, and every day got that same answer. By now, he'd lost his patience. He said, "Now, look, hon, I don't know what the gimmick is or the gag is, but every morning, I've been getting that same ridiculous answer. Now, what is it?" She says, "It's no gimmick and it's no gag. It's quite simple. Every time Cohn or Goldberg leave town, they tie up Lipschitz." But because I know this to be a legitimate Italian dialect, I want you to hear about this wonderful little Italian man who finds this the most important day of his life. Because this is the day he is to receive his final citizenship papers. He's to become a citizen of these great United States. And when called before the judge proudly, he says, "Mr. Judge, you honor, I want you to know it's the most important day for me all alive. Nothing else more important. I study very hard to learn who's the president. Who's the vice president? I know for all the cabinet. I know for the legislation, for the judicial. I know for all the government. But I just worry a little bit. Maybe you're not going to give me my citizen papers because I don't talk such good English." And the judge said, "So long as I sit here, you'll get any goddamn thing you want." And here's a man who's been on his back with a bad coronary for some 7 or 8 months. Medical science had almost given him up. But thanks to the good Lord and a fine doctor, took a turn for the better, was up and about as if he'd never been sick a day in his life. So much so, the doctor discharged him. Here he is at home in the bosom of his family, little dreaming that this day would ever come. It's time now for them to retire for the evening. And there they are, resting quite comfortably, at peace with the world. No sleep in either of them. She happy to have him at home. He thrilled to be there. He's been away. Longingly he looks at her. finally says, honey, she said, don't be crazy. You are a sick boy. Don't start up. He said, what the hell is with you? I'm cured. You forgot your marriage vows? Marriage vows. You know, V-O-W-S, vows. She said, I didn't forget nothing, but I don't want to have on my conscience that on account of me I got a relapse. He says, what kind of relapse? I'm cured. The doctor discharged me. She says, then get a letter from the doctor. He went to the doctor, explained the situation. The doctor said, I'd be happy to give you a letter. And the doctor wrote, dear Mrs. Levine, this will attest to the fact that your husband is completely cured, is no longer under my care, and has been discharged by me. He may partake in any affair of the heart that suits his fancy. And what's more, with the advent of new drugs within recent years, he's practically a 20-year-old. He read this and said, doctor, do me a favor. Cross out where it says Mrs. Levine and put into whom it may concern.